From WGCU, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. A disease viewed as an historic scourge is somehow infecting more and more people in Southwest Florida. Syphilis is making a comeback. The sexually transmitted disease has been diagnosed in more and more people over the past several years, adding up to an overall increase of more than 70%. We'll talk with healthcare professionals about this increase and find out what the modern prognosis is for what was once a deadly disease. Plus, a controversial mining operation has been given the green light in Manatee County. Mosaic will now be allowed to double the size of its Wingate East phosphate mine, which is currently 3,000 acres. We'll talk with a reporter covering that story and an environmental advocate about fears of a repeat performance of Mosaic's spill last year in Polk County when 200 million gallons of polluted water were dumped into the Floridian aquifer. But first, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Manatee County has said okay to a request by Mosaic to double the size of its phosphate mine. There was contentious debate before that vote, but it went through anyway, with five commissioners voting in favor, two against. We'll talk with the NPR reporter on that story and one of the environmental advocates against that expansion a little later in the show. But first, syphilis is most often associated with the demise of historical figures, people like Oscar Wilde, Al Capone, Vladimir Lenin, Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec, and that makes it feel like a disease that's no longer of concern. But that's definitely not the case, especially here in Southwest Florida, where the number of people turning up with the disease has grown rapidly for the past few years. Diana Pratt has been watching these numbers. She's the Area 8 STD Program Director with Florida's Department of Health and joins us in the studio. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us by phone today is Dr. Doug Brust. He's an infectious disease physician with Lee Health, currently serving as a Lee Health HIV Program Director and a staff clinician at McGregor Clinic. Thanks for being here, Dr. Brust.
Oh, thanks so much.
We are talking about the staggering increase in syphilis cases in Florida. You can call in with your thoughts at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Diana Pratt, this seems like a blast from the past. Syphilis is something that you hear about from King Henry VIII's era, or maybe as late as the early 1900s or the roaring 20s, but it's really making a comeback across the country, and especially in Florida. What's going on?
Well, we are definitely seeing a huge increase. Since 2011, when we had a little over 4,000 cases, we've jumped all the way up to over 7,000 cases, very close to 8,000 cases. And we're just seeing a lot more people having sex without using condoms, having multiple partners, anonymous sex. It's really getting out of control.
Do people just think that it's something from the past and it's not to be worried about?
That's exactly right. It's just like with TB. People think it doesn't exist in this country anymore, and unfortunately, it really does.
I just find it amazing because whenever I hear something about syphilis, I just always think of these historical figures that were notoriously brought down by syphilis. You know, people like Al Capone. It wasn't being a gangster. It was the syphilis that did him in. And it just seems like such a historical thing. And you're telling me it's not.
Right. And you're right. Actually, decades ago, if you recall, people had to get tested for syphilis before they got married. And they had to show that if they tested positive, they were treated before they could actually get married. And then the numbers dropped so low that, you know, wasn't a need anymore. But now we're seeing the numbers skyrocket. So we really need to get the word out that syphilis is definitely in the picture.
Yeah. Dr. Doug Brust with Lee Health, can you tell me about the disease? How do people get this?
First of all, thank you for having me and discussing this very important disease that we're seeing in such high numbers here in Southwest Florida. It's an infectious disease. It's sexually transmitted. Either mostly what we're discussing today is from between sexual partners. But it can also be transmitted via mother to child, congenital syphilis. And there's also rare cases of bloodborne transfusion syphilis, which happened early in the day before we started screening the blood supply for it. Basically, if a patient is infected, they develop a sore. Sometimes these sores, they're called chancres, are in areas where they cannot see them, for example, vaginally or anally. And also, classically, the sores are not painful. They're asymptomatic. The treponeme, which is a type of bacteria that causes syphilis, actually produces a chemical that's like an anesthetic so that you can't classically feel when the sore is there. And it's a basic transmission that occurs when you have a sore touching another form of mucous membrane or a rash that's loaded with treponemes touching another person that's uninfected that transmit the treponeme, the bacteria. You know, it cannot be transmitted casually, so not from toilet seats or using the gym or using someone's towels, but it does rely on intimate exposure.
So is that just with contact, with sex, sexual contact, or, I mean, kissing? What if somebody has a sore in their mouth?
Well, it can occur. You can have the potential for mouth exposure with kissing and oral sex. You can get chancres in your mouth, on your lips, on your tongue. So any form of sexual activity or intimate contact where the chancre can come in contact with another person's mucous membrane can result in transmission. The most common form, however, is usually genital, depending on the sexual preferences.
And then, so it shows up first as this sore with that really tricky little local anesthetic that the bacteria produces, which is pretty pretty sly.
Evolutionary knife.
Yeah.
But it's bacteria.
Like, yeah, way to survive. But then after that, what happens?
Well, that shows up about a good probably 60% of people, 70% of people develop one of these sores, which is characteristically looks like a rosebud pattern. And it's got like a humped up outer circle around it that's hard and the inside is softer. And it can be very small. And that develops about 3 weeks after exposure, anywhere from 10 days to 90 days in a good majority of patients, but not everyone. And that will heal on its own. But people then, a good percentage of people, probably another 75% of people, go from that stage onto the secondary stage, which is called secondary syphilis. And that's when they develop characteristic rash and fever, and they get swollen lymph nodes. And it feels like they have a flu. And they have multiple other presenting signs and symptoms that they can have when they have secondary syphilis. In fact, you know, syphilis is called the great masquerader because when we see it, it can look like multiple other types of diseases. So you have to always keep thinking about syphilis. When you develop secondary syphilis, you're highly infectious, and including the rash itself, which is infectious. And there are other forms of the rash which occur in the mucous membrane areas, like on anywhere that there's moist mucous membrane, so the lips, or in the genital area, or in the buttock region, where there are lesions called condyloma lata, not to be confused with condyloma cuminata, which is HPV disease, but condyloma lata that actually are teeming with treponemes and really, truly can transmit the bacteria rapidly and effectively.
So once it gets there, is it treatable at that point?
It's treatable at every stage. Syphilis, unbelievably, is still highly sensitive to plain old penicillin. And we think that's because it's such a small, the genome of the organism is so tiny that it hasn't been able to evolve a mechanism to become resistant to penicillin. So the treatment of choice is penicillin, and it's got to be a long-acting, high dose of penicillin, so you can't take it really orally. It has to be given either intravenously or, in most cases, intramuscularly from a shot. But it's extremely sensitive to penicillin, and everyone can be cured by using penicillin.
Well, that's good news. It did get that sneaky little way of giving you a local anesthetic, but it still hasn't gotten around the penicillin.
Yeah, no, it's actually amazing. There's very few organisms to date that really haven't developed resistance to some of the common antibiotics, and syphilis is one of them.
Well, we are talking about the staggering increase in syphilis cases in Florida, and you can call in with your thoughts at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Diana Pratt, we talked about stage one, stage two, when it becomes a rash everywhere else. Then it kind of can lie dormant in people. And then what is the stage four?
Well, actually, if we can go back to the third stage, which is the early latent syphilis, it's not exactly dormant. What happens is the symptoms are no longer visible on the outside because, you know, the body has basically heal them. But then inside, the treponema is still replicating, and it's in the bloodstream. It's traveling through the bloodstream all through the body, and it's infecting every area of the body. It can infect the bones, the heart, the brain, really every area of the body. And then after the person has been infected more than a year, then that goes into what we call the latent stage of syphilis. And if the person is otherwise healthy and their immune system is otherwise strong, the syphilis bacteria actually replicates pretty slowly, which is a good thing. But if they have a poor immune system, let's say because they're also HIV positive or they have cancer or some other immunocompromised condition, then the bacteria can replicate much quicker and cause damage a lot faster and can lead to neurosyphilis, cardiovascular syphilis, blindness, deafness, dementia, many other terrible side effects.
Those are the ones that you hear about mainly from history, too.
Right. But the one point I would like to make is that, just to add to that, is that central nervous system involvement, neurosyphilis, can occur at any stage of the disease. The treponemes actually disseminate to the central nervous system right after infection. So when a person has primary, secondary, or, as we were talking about, tertiary syphilis, they can also have central nervous system involvement. So that's a clinical diagnosis that we have to that we've learned more about as syphilis has rebounded again here in the United States.
And I'm wondering, Diana, with all the new cases that we're hearing about, are they new cases of newly infected people, or are they people that may have been infected long ago that are showing up and suddenly able to show symptoms again because they've come down with some other immune-compromising situation?
Well, a huge number of the cases are new cases. We're seeing a lot of that. We are also seeing people who had never previously tested positive for syphilis that are perhaps older and are now testing positive. And so, you know, they could be older cases, and maybe they just, like I said, never got tested. And so if they're showing symptoms, then like Dr. Brust said, they're easily treatable. They don't have to go into the hospital and have the 10 to 14 days of aqueous IV penicillin. But it's kind of a mix. We're seeing a lot of new infectious cases. And then we're also seeing quite a few latent cases, as we call them, where we don't know for sure how long the person has had it. And they have no symptoms whatsoever, but they do have a positive test result and a positive confirmatory result.
Wow. So, Dr. Brust, we talked a while back about the rise in cases of HIV/AIDS in Florida. Do you think that some of these new syphilis cases are connected to that?
Absolutely. In fact, I was going to ask about with our increase in Southwest Florida, the epidemiology of it. Are you seeing it mostly in gay men that are HIV positive, or just in gay men?
Actually, we are seeing a huge increase in gay men who are HIV positive, and we see higher numbers of men who have sex with men who are HIV infected and also have syphilis versus, you know, heterosexuals or gay men who are not HIV positive. We're seeing a lot more syphilis cases.
So the graphs, the statistics that I was looking at showed that men seem to make up the bulk of the number of people infected, but of the men, are a lot of the men that are becoming infected with syphilis also HIV? I mean, what percent maybe would you say is, I mean, not on the nose, but kind of a ballpark?
Over half.
More than half of the people, mm-hmm. the men that are now showing up with syphilis also have HIV/AIDS?
Right.
Okay.
And I would say that now that, you know, I just came back from our large national meeting for HIV out in Seattle called CROI, and there's now hints that, you know, HIV has entered this phase where it's a chronic disease, and we have ways to prevent HIV. One of them is called PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, where someone who's HIV negative can take one pill once a day and prevent HIV. Well, that doesn't prevent other sexually transmitted diseases. So initially in clinical trials, we did not see an upsurge or an upswing of other sexually transmitted diseases when we started using this strategy called PrEP. But now I think in real life, when people are on PrEP, we're seeing a significant increase in sexually transmitted diseases, including chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis. And I would think, Dana, that our experience here in Southwest Florida sort of reflects that. Have you guys got data on that yet?
Not locally, because a lot of the providers in Southwest Florida just recently started administering PrEP.
Mm-hmm.
But I do foresee that. And it's very unfortunate because, you know, like Dr. Brust said, when people are afraid of catching HIV or being exposed to HIV, they're often more cautious. But when you take HIV out of the picture, a lot of times they think that every STD is treatable, and so it's not that big of a deal. They might as well just relax and have fun. And it's scary because syphilis can be deadly, and a lot of STDs maybe aren't deadly to the person who has them. but they can also be they can be deadly to babies, you know, born to mothers who are infected with syphilis, or even other STDs. Herpes can actually be deadly to babies. You know, so we want to get the word out. Syphilis is definitely something to be concerned about. A lot of men who have sex with men are bisexual. You know, we do see quite a few cases of men who maybe their wives or their girlfriends don't know that they're bisexual, but they are practicing, you know, with both sexes. And if we don't get the word out, no one's, you know, going to be prepared for it, that these, you know, there's a very easy chance of people being exposed if they have multiple partners or they're having sex without condoms and they're not in a monogamous relationship.
I'm also wondering, because it was a large number of men compared to the number of women. Is it easier for men to get this because it's harder to see the sores on a female?
No, actually what we see when we interview patients, because we always interview our patients and try to find out who their contacts are, you know, either needle-sharing contacts or sexual contacts, so that we can get those partners tested and treated as well if they're positive. We're seeing that men who have sex with men have a higher number of sex partners, so they're putting themselves more at risk. Whereas females, when we interview them, and heterosexual men, when we interview them for the interview period related to the stage of syphilis that they have, they'll generally say 1 to 2 partners. Men who have sex with men, on average, give us 4 to 5 partners, and I've seen as many as 300 partners within less than a year.
Wow.
So, you know, obviously the more people you're having sex with, the more chances you have of catching HIV and every STD.
Mm-hmm. And then, and also just to add to that, that having a ulcerative sexually transmitted disease such as syphilis in a person that's HIV negative, having syphilis increases the rate that you can acquire or the risk of acquiring HIV. So that if you have men that have a chancre are at much increased risk to acquire HIV than those compared to those that do not. So one feeds off the other. So it's incredibly important to be screened for sexually transmitted diseases if you're having unprotected sex and to be treated appropriately if you haven't been treated, and also to have your contacts treated. In the state of Florida now, we're able to, you know, treat, the clinicians are able to prescribe for sexual contacts so that the sexual contact doesn't necessarily have to go to see the doctor if you're able to get more information from the patient themselves.
So I wanted to ask also, it seems like that first lesion or the first little thing, it's kind of hard to notice that. So do people generally come in when they notice that they're starting to have rashes in other places? Is that when you're starting to see people?
Absolutely. So it all depends. You know, if someone sees an ulcer on their penis in general, they come in to see the doctor almost immediately.
Well, yeah.
They don't note, and really that's the major issue. So if they don't see it, it's either because they have it rectally or vaginally or orally. Because many people don't realize that you can, as we discussed before, can get chancres on the lips and on the tongue and in the throat. And they look a little bit like cold sores. And, you know, they're not very easy to define. But then people will get sick. And the classic thing about the secondary syphilis is you do get a rash. It almost occurs very frequently. I can't give you the exact number. I would say probably 80% of the people that have secondary syphilis have rash. And some of the salient, sort of almost pathognomonic characteristics of the rash are that you can get it on your soles and on your palms, which you don't generally have rashes from other viral and bacterial infections in that area.
Yeah. We are talking about the increase in the number of syphilis cases in the U.S. and especially here in Florida with our guest, Dr. Doug Brust with Lee Health and Diana Pratt with the Florida Department of Health. You can become part of this conversation by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK, or you can find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. We're also on Twitter at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Diana, the Florida Department of Health was so alarmed by this increase in syphilis cases that the state epidemiologist sent a letter out warning healthcare providers to be on the lookout, citing that syphilis is called the great imitator. Dr. Brust touched on that a little bit earlier, but can you explain a little bit more in detail what that means?
Sure. Like Dr. Bruss was saying, with a lot of the rashes that present with secondary syphilis, we see those rashes misdiagnosed on a daily basis by dermatologists, by primary care providers. You know, they'll often ask their patients, have you recently been gardening or hiking out in the woods, or have you changed your body wash or soap? Some other reason that you might have gotten this body rash. And 9 times out of 10, the client will say, oh, you know what? I did just change my soap, or I did just change my laundry detergent. That must be what the rash is from. And because it doesn't itch and it doesn't hurt, a lot of times the doctor will just prescribe a cortisone cream and the rash goes away by itself. So the person thinks they're totally fine. No blood test was ever done. And, you know, the bacteria is free to replicate.
And to be tested for it, it's a blood test.
Yes, it's a blood test. And there is actually a rapid test now. So we can just prick someone's finger and tell them within 20 minutes whether or not they have the antibodies to syphilis in their blood. And if that comes back reactive, then we draw a full vial of blood from their arm and send that off to the lab to make absolutely sure that it is syphilis.
And testing for syphilis is archaic. It hasn't come into its full ability to do easily. We use a very unusual testing scheme that uses treponemal and non-treponemal tests that you have to match together, and it really can be sometimes very difficult to interpret what's going on and what stage the people are at and whether they're infectious or they're not infectious. But in general, when people have early disease, like what we've been talking about, when they have a chancre or they have the rash of secondary syphilis, those patients are highly infectious. They're able to transmit the bacterium. Whereas when you get later, you really don't transmit by sexual means. You can sometimes transmit mother to child, but you are not infectious by sexual means.
And I wanted to ask about those later stages, the neurological damage. Once it gets to that stage, can anything be done?
The person can still be cured, but any damage that's been done is usually irreversible. So, you know, if they've already gone deaf or blind or already developed dementia, they may get a little better, but the damage can't be completely reversed.
So the syphilis will attack the central nervous system and cause problems to the eyes and the brain. Any number of things.
Right. A person can lose their balance. You know, it can affect every aspect of their brain and their heart. And like I said, it travels the whole body. So when a pregnant woman, for instance, is infected, as the baby's growing inside her, the entire body of the baby, including the bones and the mouth, everything in there can be infected by the bacteria as the baby's growing.
I think we can only emphasize early recognition. As we had talked about before, you have to have a high degree of suspicion. Like, for example, early in infection, you can see central nervous system involvement with the eye and also with the ear. And otosyphilis, that involving the ear, otosyphilis, we really haven't, you know, ear, nose, and throat doctors of the new generation haven't seen this disease, but it's on the upswing now. And people can present with just ringing in one ear or hearing loss. And the faster you get treatment to them, the better the chances are that you will be able to preserve their hearing. But it's the recognition that it could be caused from syphilis.
Yeah, I mean, you don't think of going to an ear, nose, and throat doctor and him being able to identify a sexually transmitted disease. I mean, what do they see in an eye?
Well, there's multiple areas of the eye that the ophthalmologist can tell that you can have an infection. And specifically syphilis. It infects multiple areas of the eye. So it just depends on, you know, whether you have it in the anterior or the posterior. There's more, the pathological findings that the ophthalmologist sees aren't necessarily specific to syphilis, because there's a lot of other infections that cause it. But you can have a high clinical suspicion by what you see when you examine the patient's eye under direct observation. And then when you send tests to see whether or not the patient's blood has antibody, then you have a better ability to say, yes, this patient has, you know, syphilis of the eye or syphilis of the ear. Dana was talking about before about people being dizzy, that they get vestibular involvement. And when you see a person that has syphilis of the ear, they get ringing in their ear, but they also, when they're walking, they look like they're drunk. Because they have an ataxia walking along and they can't keep, you know, themselves walking straight.
Which reminds me of a story that I heard about an old brewer in Germany years ago. The place was called Schlenkerlach because the guy could not walk straight, and it turns out later that that was what the problem was.
Yeah, no, it's. I mean, everyone has their stories about syphilis. It's just that we all have to keep it really right in the front of our mind, like tuberculosis and like HIV. You have to, in order for the patient to have the disease, the doctor has to think of it. Because if the doctor doesn't think, it seems like a very common sense thing, but if the doctor doesn't think of the disease, the patient can't have it.
Well, it's just seen as historic. So you just, I mean, I don't know. I'm sure doctors are more educated than most, but I mean, it just seems like something that's so in the past that this kind of sending out.
Well, it depends on how old you are and what the past is. Because the 80s were, you know, were the past for some of us, but
yeah.
They're also not that far back. But that's during the time when HIV was spreading, there was quite a bit of syphilis. And in the 70s and 80s. And there were large, you know, you would see quite a few number of people that had syphilis, and this was during the time period that HIV was being introduced into the community.
So I wanted to talk more about neurosyphilis. You said that you said earlier that it requires hospitalization?
Normally it's 10 to 14 days of IV aqueous penicillin. But there are some providers now that can actually, I believe, prescribe a pump, and then the client would just go and have the pump refilled on a daily basis. And so they could, you know, go to work. They could do what they needed to do as long as the pumps, you know, kept injecting them with the penicillin.
So when I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about when you go to the hospital, you say you have chest pain, you're definitely in. I mean, you're going into the hospital whether you like it or not. When you present at a hospital with neurosyphilis like this, do they consider that a life-threatening thing where they are going to make you get treatment?
Usually your provider would have set it up with the hospital in advance. And so they would, you know, set an appointment for you. You would be checked in. You wouldn't have to go through the emergency room or anything like that.
Are there people that deny going forward with treatment?
Absolutely.
What is that about?
We've seen quite a few very elderly people just say, you know what, I've got to die of something. I'm already in my 70s, 80s, 90s. I feel fine. I don't really see the point. I don't want to go in the hospital for 2 weeks.
And so with those people, the elderly people that it looks like latent syphilis that they have of unknown duration, and they might have central nervous system involvement, the actual benefit from penicillin at that point to, for example, if they have a dementia, is, you know, very questionable. It's the patients that we're seeing that are acute, that have secondary syphilis or primary syphilis, that have an acute CNS presentation, either a stroke, which you can get meningovascular syphilis, or, as I was talking before, affecting the ear or the balance or the eye, that we get them in and we get them treated. And even in those cases, unfortunately, patients will leave and will not stay for the intravenous penicillin. And the biggest problem is that their insurance, or they don't have insurance, so they're unable to be covered. So at that time, we have to rely on, you know, charity foundations through Lee Health to be able to get some of the patients treated, because it is a public health issue, along with, you know, a personal issue of having syphilis, central nervous system syphilis.
And at the other end of the spectrum, what is the prognosis of a child born to somebody that has syphilis? You said that it gets all the way into that baby's system as the mother is pregnant.
Right. If the mother contracts syphilis while she's pregnant, let's say in the, you know, the first trimester or the second trimester, and is not treated quickly, the baby is literally growing with the bacteria inside its bloodstream, inside its body. And then if the, you know, basically if the mother is treated adequately and then the baby is put on treatment right when the baby is born, if it's necessary, usually the prognosis is good. Any damage that's already been done is not reversible. But we have seen cases where it's not diagnosed and the baby is not diagnosed upon birth or the baby's not put on treatment soon enough, and babies can actually die. So babies can be born stillborn from syphilis, or they could be born alive and then die, you know, within a few days.
Because it's attacked their nervous system?
Their entire body, right.
The whole thing. You see, mm-hmm. It goes into their bones and everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one aspect, I mean, syphilis we could talk for hours about, but one aspect we sort of haven't even hinted about is how we actually know what happens to people that have untreated syphilis, the natural history of the disease. And if you recall, that was the Tuskegee studies that occurred in African-American men in the early 1930s up until 1972, where they were filed, these men were filed, even though, not immediately, but even though there was a known treatment for syphilis available, they were filed to determine the natural history of syphilis. So this was a real, real tragedy that occurred and has left still stigma for African Americans participating in clinical trials in the United States to this date.
Well, psychologically, there is risk at not dealing with it, not handling it, not getting treated, but there's also the, I'm not going to get this because it's something from the past. So who is at greatest risk of not trying to protect themselves? Is it older people who are no longer worried about pregnancy and they're not worried, so they forget about STDs and they think that it's not going to be an issue? Or is it different cultural groups that just don't want to deal with that type of protection?
Well, Diana, you want to handle that?
I don't know who wants to take a stab at that. But I know we have a lot of older people that get divorced, they get widowed, they go back into the dating scene, and the world, you know, has changed, but they may be of a different, older set of standards or mindset or behaviors. And then different groups of people think that there may be, you know, stigma attached with using condoms, something as simple as that.
And so as far as absolute numbers, it's not that population. You see the absolute highest numbers. However, the scenario you put forth is exactly what happens. You can see HIV cases like that. You can see syphilis cases like that. And, you know, people that have, you know, either are widowed or, you know, out of the dating scene for a long time, and they come back in as the Viagra generation, we like to say. And now, you know, they're older. They're senior citizens, which I've just joined in two more weeks I joined that level of I guess, age.
Wisdom.
And they go back into the dating scene, and they can get HIV. They can get anything. But the vast number of people that we're seeing, really, are people that are using, at least with gay men who have sex with men, they're using these dating apps on their cell phones where they're meeting and having consensual but essentially anonymous sex.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been quite a bit of you know, public health publications that have come out that looked at these dating apps. Actually, NPR actually had a special on this nationwide. I can't remember which program it was on. That people are meeting, they're having sex, and syphilis and HIV are being transmitted through these sort of social media groups.
Yeah, and I want to – we're running out of time, but I wanted to wrap it up, no pun intended, with prevention. So the number one way to prevent is condoms?
Condoms and staying in monogamous relationships, having new partners tested and yourself tested before engaging in sex.
Okay. Dr. Brust, anything to add to that?
It's the same way you would being tested, being aware, educating yourself and your partners, and also not playing the blame game. You know, this is just a bacterium out making a living, just like, you know, HIV is a virus out making a living. You know, there's not blame associated with it. Find out that you have the disease, like any other disease, get treated, eradicate it, and then don't get it again.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there for now, but I want to thank you both for being part of the show, Dr. Doug Brust with Lee Health and Diana Pratt with the Florida Department of Health. Thank you both for the information.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
All right. Coming up, the Mosaic Mining Company walked away with a big win in Manatee County. They'll now be able to double the size of their operation there in spite of pleas by environmental advocates to deny the company's request. We'll have more on that story after this break.